Anna Forney, recording an interview with Broadnax Cameron. The date is January 27, 1975. Mr. Cameron, I have always been fascinated with your memories and recollections of your educational process, which seems to have been particularly versed in the classics, because you can always come up with apt quotations. So I'd like you to talk a little about that.
Well, first of all, I went to two schools and two colleges. My first school was primary school run by the deserving widow of a Confederate veteran who needed the money, and who held it in her house. She happened, I think, to have been an excellent teacher. From there, I went to lower sixth form in Gilliman, in which I spent several weeks and then was promoted to first form upper school. I did the six upper forms in 5 years. I began Latin in the first form of upper school of Gilman. I did 6 years of Latin at Gilman. In those days, to get an A.B. degree, one had to have Latin and Greek or German. I took 1 year of German and didn't get along at all well. A friend of my wife's taught me, or tried to teach me. The next year I switched to Greek, and I took 4 years of Greek in 3 years at Gilman. This enabled me to get into Princeton as a candidate for an A.B. degree. French was absolutely necessary, and I don't remember how many years of French I had at Gilman in the 5 years I was there. But it was not an elective for college entrance in those days. While I was in Gilman, in 1910, I think, Edward VII died. Closely related to the Church of England, their funeral services were held in Episcopal churches in this country, and I attended the funeral of Edward VII at St. David's Church in Roland Park. It must be remembered that the King of England was then the defender of the faith and the head of the Protestant Episcopal churches. Another great event while I was at Gilman was an air meet in the 1910 or 11 with Blériot and all the famous flyers, the Wright brothers, Glenn Curtis, etc. There was a gentleman in Baltimore who was a railroad engineer, and he built the Trans-Siberian Railroad for the Tsar. The Tsar presented him with a vast country place outside of Baltimore called the Crimea, and a townhouse which took up a full block and had funny zebra-striped sentry boxes at the door, which the Russians apparently thought was what you had to have in a place. His son moved to a house built by Stanford White, and was a confirmed invalid. He had never seen a plane. He was very anxious to see a plane, and he put up a prize of $5,000 for anyone who would dare to fly a flying machine past his window, where his bed was. The Count de Latham, in an Antoinette machine, took up the dare, and all of us from the Gilman School were taken into Baltimore and taken up to the roof of the Belvedere, and we witnessed the first flight of a plane over a city. Heretofore, they had never flown over a city on account of the rough up and down currents. The Count de Latham collected his $5,000. There was a terrific German influence in Baltimore in those days, and music was very important. The faculty of Gilman School, many of them, were expert musicians, and we had violin and piano concerts, and one especially a gentleman sang very well. So we were raised, had a great deal of music in the evenings, after supper and before study hall, in the common room at Gilman. After Gilman, I went to Princeton. In Princeton, for the first 2 years, one had no electives. One had to take Latin and Greek and French and mathematics and either physics or chemistry. It was only after end of sophomore year that one could elect and choose a department. As I then thought it, I wanted to be an architect. I majored in the School of Art and Archaeology and Architecture at Princeton, beginning with my junior year. I had two courses in that school, which really is amounted to a terrific study of history, because it was the history of painting and sculpture and architecture. These courses went on for 2 years. As electives, I kept on with my Latin and kept on with my mathematics. I dropped Greek because my foundation in Greek was very poor indeed. I never really mastered the Greek alphabet. The last Greek course I had, however, was deciphering fragments of monuments and trying to guess what was in the missing places in the inscriptions. It was quite a struggle for me. For some reason or other, I was allowed to take a graduate course in the history of architecture. It was a 5-year course, but I only took a 1-year section of it, which year was devoted to the years after Augustus Caesar. Everybody had to have a project, and the project assigned to me was the recreation of Diocletian's palace at Spoleto, now called Split in Yugoslavia, for which I had to make drawings and so on from textbooks and guess what was there from the foundations and what was left of the palace. It was a very interesting thing. The rest of the time, we fooled with early Christian churches in Asia Minor, which had developed a new and completely different style of architecture from the classical. There were 6 people in the course. It was held 2 afternoons a week from 3 o'clock until tea time in the luxurious quarters of the master of the graduate college, and there we spent a couple of hours until tea was brought in and served to us. The master of the graduate college, who taught the course, or rather assigned the work to the students and criticized what we did, was also the one man in the world who knew the deserts of Asia Minor. His name was Howard Crosby Butler, and he had made a great many archaeological expeditions into the deserts, finding neglected spots that heretofore had not been discovered. He was an expert mathematician and navigator, and he noted down 3 times a day in his notebook his latitude and longitude and all these the appropriate things like that. So in Allenby, in World War I, had to have maps of the Arabian Desert. The only person in the world who could supply the maps was Mr. Butler. He was engaged busily in drawing maps for Allenby's army in the Asia Minor, and his door was always guarded by two British sentries. There was a British officer stationed in Princeton whose job was to take a map when completed and rush it down to the British Embassy in Washington. Mr. Butler was so precise and exact that he could recreate the terrain and the various places from his observation of the sun and the stars and the moon, etc. After I graduated from Princeton in 1919 instead of 1918, because there was a little episode in which there was a war, and that put me back almost a year. After that, I went to the University of Virginia for law school and spent 3 years studying law at the University of Virginia, where we had one very charming, delightful, cultivated, scholarly professor who spoke in simple terms and whose lectures was magnificently lucid and entertaining and witty and brilliant.
Reminded me of them.
I've been asked to say something about how I won World War I. I was an expert soldier. An expert soldier is one who avoids danger and finds the best food and lodging everywhere. I enlisted in the first part of May 1917 in the old American Ambulance, which later became the American Field Service, and drove an ambulance, was scheduled to drive an ambulance, rather, for the French in France. I got as far as Paris, and they asked for volunteers to go down to the Balkans, which was considered especially dangerous. For some reason, unbeknownst to me, I volunteered. It was extremely dangerous because it took weeks and weeks to get from Paris down to Salonika, or Salonique as the French call it, then 3 days to get from Salonika up to the front. By that time, the front was stabilized, and there was hardly anything doing, praise God. There was a unit of 20 Americans attached to a division of the French Army. It was the ambulance division for the Army. When they changed the divisions, however, as they did from time to time, we were always attached to the new division and detached from the old one because we had a remarkable record of being always keeping our ambulances running. This was achieved by lying and cheating. We were only supposed to have 20 ambulances. We had 21. The one extra ambulance was nothing in the world but a source of spare parts. When we needed a part for one of the 20 ambulances to keep it going, we took it off the extra ambulance and ordered a new part for it, which was weeks in coming. In December 1917, the United States Army took us over and ordered us back to Paris, and there we were deactivated and sent back to the United States. I then went back to Princeton and joined an ROTC unit and was drilling magnificently with the wrong foot and the wrong hand and everything when the commanding officer lined us all up and asked if anybody knew anything about airplane engines. For some reason, his eye fastened on me, and he said, "Cameron, what do you know about engines?" And I said, "Not, sir, nothing at all. I wouldn't know how to scrape a bearing." He said, "Jesus Christ, you know a bearing has to be scraped. Go down and report to the air service." I did report to the Air Service and was assigned to the Airplane Engines Ground School to instruct pilots in the mysteries of a gasoline engine. The course was 1 week for these would-be pilots, and I took the course for 1 week, and the next week, after the fashion of the Army, I was supposed to be able to teach it. At any rate, I was made to teach it. I didn't do too well at first, but I did get along pretty well in the end, and the most difficult subject were rotary engines. And finally, I was promoted to be the sole teacher of rotary engines. At that time, I was still ranked as a buck private in the United States Army, but I drew flying pay. I'd never flown. I drew, of course, free uniforms and everything. An allowance for food and instructor's pay and air service pay. And while other buck privates were getting $30 a month, I was getting $125 a month, which in 1918 was big money. The group of instructors took over two of the luxurious Princeton clubs. We lived in these clubs. Some of the instructors couldn't pass physical examinations, and they were therefore civilian instructors. No liquor was allowed within 10 miles of an Army post during World War I. Trenton was 12 miles away, and plenty of liquor was available in Trenton. Hence the civilian instructors went over to Trenton several times a week and got a large supply of liquor. This was brought to the club and given to the steward of the club. We ate in one club and slept in two. And before lunch and before dinner every day, cocktails and drinks were passed to us privates on great big black waiters like trays like waiters used to have, and we had our fill of cocktails and drinks before lunch and before dinner. We did no teaching. In the afternoon, we had to correct papers. At that time, the French Army was used as a slogan, "On ne passe pas," they shall not pass. As we corrected the papers of the would-be cadets, we adopted the French slogan. With the signing of the armistice, the ground school at Princeton was deactivated, and we were all sent, not all of us, but some of us were sent down to Texas, to Austin, Texas, to the ground school there. They had more teachers than they knew what to do with, and we found ourselves with more leisure than we knew what to do with. We spent from the armistice on until January, when I managed to wangle a discharge, I suppose honorable. My friend and I, who was a machine gun instructor, spent our time sitting in the rotunda of the state capitol because it and the movie theater were the only place in Austin that had central heating. And the rooming house where we had put in had, was very, very cold. It was one of those nasty cold winters. And so my war service ended by sitting in the rotunda of the state capitol at Austin. Sic transit gloria mundi. I've been asked to talk about my favorite professor at the University of Virginia Law School. He was an old gentleman in my day, 1922, I was in the class of 22, who wore a boil shirt and a black string tie, and when lecturing, shoes. He, of course, was a young man in the days of the Reconstruction era and was not accustomed to shoes. And as soon as he got off the podium at the lecture room, he went up to his office in the law building and took off his shoes. and didn't put them on again until he had to lecture again. He was never comfortable in them, but always delightful. He wrote a little pamphlet on a point of very dubious point of evidence, which was entirely opposed to everything then in all the courts. For some reason or other, the courts of Virginia, probably because most of the judges in Virginia had been to Virginia Law School and knew Dr. Graves, followed this revolution in the law of evidence. However, Dean Pound of Harvard or Yale, I forget which, took a great interest in it also, and one day the old gentleman, sitting in his office without his shoes, receives a postcard from Dean Pound, which says, "The House of Lords has reversed the rule of evidence and followed yours and cited your pamphlet." Some months later, there was a second postcard from Dean Pound. "Again, the House of Lords has cited your brochure and followed your revolution of the law of evidence." His reference area was astounding. He used to teach us Mother Goose rhymes. He used Shakespeare. He used French because he had taught French at one time as a young man to the Confederate veterans who were older than he. But he was 17 or 18 and no shoes, and the Confederate veterans, some of them went back to college, and old Dr. Graves in his youth had taught French at Washington and Lee University. I think it was then just Washington University. One of his biblical references came from Deuteronomy, I think, but he read from the Bible at the opening of a lecture as to how Moses would come home tired at night from judging the rows between the children of Israel. It wore him out. At the time, Jethro, his father-in-law, was visiting Moses, and Jethro said to Moses that you ought to appoint judges to hear these things, men devoid of covetousness, men of great character. And then says the Bible, Moses took, Moses took his father-in-law's advice. Old Dr. Graves read this sentence, smacked his lips and reread it, and Moses took his father-in-law's advice. "Gentlemen, I find that harder to believe than any other miracle in the Bible." I should have said, when I was talking about my brilliant career in the air service, by the way, I first flew in 1928. I took a commercial plane from New York to Baltimore to see what it was like. Remember, the war in which I taught was over in 1918. However, as a child, in the early 1900s, and I don't know the date because I was a little child, the Wright brothers came to the Virginia State Fair with their funny little box-like kite thing, and they put it in the infield of the racetrack. And I was sent over with some other boys, friends of mine, to see the Wright brothers fly. And we got there about 11 o'clock in the morning, and the Wright brothers had a tent also in the infield, and one of them would come out and sniff the air, and we would hope for some action, and he would dive back in the tent. They always had on leather puttees and their caps on backwards and goggles. Eventually, after hours for these poor little kids waiting with their faces pressed against the board fence that surrounded the infield, one of the Wrights, I've never known which one it was, came out and got into the airplane, and they dropped the pylon weight and he went down the railway, which then was a way of launching the plane, and off he took in the air, and he flew twice around a half a mile track, about what altitude of 40 feet, and landed in the airfield, in the infield, I mean. And this was my only experience with flying before I became an instructor in the Air Service U.S. Army.